Okay, so we're going to stick with the embryo, and it's really a pleasure for me to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Anna Katarina Hadjiantonakis. I asked Kat for a bio sketch, and she said to just tell you what I know, which I think is a test to see if I've been paying attention in the past 13 years. So Kat did her undergraduate work in London at the Imperial College at the University of London. She also did her PhD also at the Imperial College, and after this moved to Samuel Lundenfeld Research Institute in Toronto, where she did a postdoctoral fellowship with Andras Nagy. She subsequently moved to Ginny Papione's lab at Columbia University, where she did a second postdoctoral fellowship, and this is where I met Kat. When Kat joined the lab, we knew that she was a force to behold. We expected great things, and she has not disappointed. She became an associate faculty member at Sloan Kettering Institute, where she is now pursuing her research interest, which is vast. And what I think most people should know about Kat is that she generates these resources that is used worldwide. And so Kat really believed that you couldn't study development by looking at static pictures. And so what she has done is generate the resource that she needed to look at her research question. And the research question that she's now pursuing, and she's going to tell you a little bit about, is how endoderm is formed. And so she's really a nice follow-up to Yujiro's. So we've set up the body plan, and now Kat is going to tell you what the next few steps are. Kat.
Thanks, Lloydie, and thank you for the organizers for inviting me. And I have to say it's been really great to be back in Canada and visiting sort of Montreal and sort of meeting a lot of your sort of trainees in your program. Okay, so what I thought I would do today is tell you about some of our interests. Because we had Yujiro talk about pre-implantation, I thought I would talk about post-implantation and a subject that when I started my lab at Sloan Kettering, I never thought I would be working on, and that is the formation of the gut endoderm. Okay. So as Yujiro has told you, the pre-implantation period really serves to specify three lineages and to segregate them. And there's sort of the epiblast that will form sort of the embryo, and then the primitive endoderm and trophectoderm that will form the placenta and sort of our fetal membranes. Because mice, like all mammals, sort of develop in utero and require sort of for their development the formation of extraembryonic tissues. Okay. And everything I'm going to tell you about today will be using the mouse as a sort of genetically and effectively embryologically tractable model. Okay, so this is just to summarize that where Yujiro sort of left off, which is the formation of the blastocyst, and what I'm going to talk about today is gastrulation. And in my lab, we use gastrulation really as a model for understanding cell lineage specification and sort of tissue remodeling, sort of morphogenetic movements that give rise to different tissue layers. And one of the sort of the dogmas of mammalian development is that in principle, by the time of implantation, you specified the pluripotent epiblast and two extraembryonic tissues, and the idea being that the entire fetus will arise from the pluripotent epiblast tissue. And even though I'm not going to go into details about sort of lineage sort of contributions, I'd just like to highlight that some of the data that I will show you challenge this view by suggesting that descendants of this primitive endoderm, and this is just shown here in a sort of a schematic projected a different way, and I'm going to suggest that descendants of the primitive endoderm layer that Yujiro told you about may actually contribute to the embryo proper. Sort of thereby sort of challenging the dogma of lineage, extraembryonic and embryonic lineage segregation in embryonic, mammalian embryonic development. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is the gut endoderm. And the gut endoderm is really the precursor tissue, and it's the tissue that forms the progenitors of the respiratory and digestive tracts and associated organs, such as the lungs, the liver, the pancreas, the stomach. And essentially, the gut endoderm, as most of you know it, runs the head to tail of the embryo. And I'm going to have to sort of give you a disclaimer here, where a lot of previous speakers have tried to categorize themselves in terms of working above or beneath the head. the embryos that I'm working on have no heads or no shoulders. And essentially, we're talking about sort of earlier stages than this. And what I'd like to just point out, that even though at mid-gestation, the endoderm runs as an internal tube along the length of the embryo, when it forms on the surface of the embryo at gastrulation. So really what I'm going to show you are cup-shaped embryos looking at the distal embryonic region, and we're going to be looking on the surface. Okay, so a little bit about the sort of the peculiarities in the mouse, and this is just the blastocyst stage embryo as sort of discussed by Yojiro, and this is just to show you that after implantation, at early post-implantation, the configuration of tissues is maintained such that the epiblast is now a hollow sort of a cup. This is a cross-section, and it's bounded by the visceral endoderm, which we're going to hear a lot about, that is a derivative of the trophectoderm, shown here in light blue, and the extraembryonic endoderm over here, or the extraembryonic ectoderm, which is sort of derived from the trophectoderm. And essentially, the embryo expands, but the apposition of tissues sort of remains the same. Okay. So effectively, what the process of gastrulation serves to do, at least in the mouse, and I would say in all sort of vertebrates and invertebrates, is to form the definitive tissue layers or germ layers. And what it does is it converts an embryo comprising two tissue layers, the columnar epithelial epiblast and this visceral endoderm that's derived from the primitive endoderm, sort of two epithelia, into ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm, the three definitive germ layers. And essentially we'll be focusing on this process. In the mouse, as sort of in other amniotes, a structure forms that's referred to as the primitive streak. This is a structure that defines the posterior of the embryo and through which cells undergo an epithelial to mesenchymal transition. Cells of the epiblast will fall into the streak and they will migrate away as two wings of mesoderm, a mesenchymal population of cells. And they will circumnavigate the space between the outer visceral endoderm epithelium, which by this time is a squamous epithelium, and the inner columnar epithelial sort of, epiblast. And this is just shown here in a scanning EM, where you can see that the mesoderm has a very distinct morphology from the epiblast and the endoderm. And effectively, the mesoderm is fueled by cells coming out of the primitive streak, which is a posteriorly positioned growth zone. So what happens to the endoderm? I've been very sort of vague in this sort of calling this the endoderm, where I've told you about visceral endoderm, and to begin with, I discussed talked about the gut endoderm. So when I started my lab, I really couldn't quite understand how the endoderm formed. But this is sort of a summary of the data that was out there, and this is just data for an extraembryonic of endoderm marker, or a so-called extraembryonic endoderm marker, HNF4-alpha, at this stage. Before gastrulation, it covers the entire conceptus. This is the embryonic region, the extraembryonic region. This is actually a 3D reconstruction of a confocal Z-stack, as will be many of my images. And then during gastrulation, it's seen to be sort of displaced to the posterior, sort of presumpting extraembryonic region. The embryonic region lies over here. And sort of taking data like that from markers, in addition to some very coarse fate mapping data, one could come up with a model like this, whereby sort of cells coming out of the primitive streak will form the mesoderm and the endoderm. The endoderm will form an epithelium that arises, we know from the fate mapping, from the anterior tip of the primitive streak, which will be down here. And it will insert, expand, and displace this extraembryonic visceral endoderm, so epithelium, in light blue here, to these extraembryonic regions. And this is sort of my sort of interpretation as to how this movement might happen, that endoderm cells sort of are specified within the primitive streak, and they sort of arise down the bottom over here, insert, and sort of push this out the way. Okay. So a couple of years ago, when I started my lab, what we wanted to do is to generate reporters to try and understand cellular dynamics driving gastrulation. And one of the reporters we decided to make, just as a negative stain, was a reporter of the visceral endoderm. And this is just cis-regulatory elements that had been defined from the alpha fetal protein locus, driving just GFP, and this is just the raw data, a confocal Z-stack, just to show you that this just labels the surface of the embryo, the visceral endoderm. And there'll be a lot of 3D projections using this reporter. I'm trying to, most of the data, so I will show you using this reporter. So what we decided to do is to take this kind of reporter and time-lapse image it to look at this sort of displacement event over here, that we'd see sort of GFP sort of all over the embryo, and then we'd see it being pushed back. And sort of to our surprise, what we started to note, and this is just the first frame of a time lapse, this is actually a 3D reconstruction, and I'm going to play it over time in a minute, is that there were regions devoid of fluorescence, which sort of was a little bit suspicious and not what we expected. If we played this over time, let me just see if it will play, you will see that the regions devoid of fluorescence expand or increase in number, and that the region that is GFP positive is not displaced. Instead, it's dispersed. And this just schematizes over here what we expected. So some sequentially staged embryos, what we expected, which is my Photoshop rendition of what we expected. And this is real data of what we observed. And these were essentially displaced cells overlying the epiblast. So these were cells of an extraembryonic origin that are in contact with the embryo, suggesting that they may be poised to contribute to the cut endoderm of the embryo proper. And this over here just schematizes our sort of revised model for endoderm morphogenesis. This is sort of what we affectionately refer to as the prevailing or previous displacement model, and this is our dispersal model. To confirm that this was actually the case, we generated additional reporter through mice, sort of using different sort of unrelated visceral endoderm sort of cis-regulatory elements, in this time driving red fluorescent protein. We generated double transgenics and showed that we could label the same population of cells. We also generated Cre recombinase, sort of a mice, spread them to Cre reporters and could identify the same population of cells. Okay, so essentially what these observations sort of suggest is that the gut endoderm, the precursor tissue of the respiratory and digestive tracts and associated organs, comprises cells of two distinct origins. One, definitive endoderm, which is epiblast-derived, and the other being sort of extraembryonic or a previously believed to be extraembryonic tissue, visceral endoderm. And this is just a ventral view of a 7.5-day embryo, sort of an embryo that's been gastrulating for just over 24 hours, where you can see the gut endoderm, the yolk sac, which is an extraembryonic tissue, and over here the midline. I'm not going to talk about the midline, but I know that there is some interest from at least some people in the audience with respect to the midline and midline morphogenesis. But what we noted was that these extraembryonic cells sort of decorate the midline, suggesting that midline formation is distinct but coordinated with gut endoderm formation. Okay, so firstly, before I go on, why can we see cells in places where no one else could? And I think this is a cautionary tale for people generating reporters in any of their favorite model organisms. Okay, so this is a sort of AFP-GFP, and it could be one of our red fluorescent or cherry reporters, and we see the same thing. An embryo at an early bud stage where we can actually see sort of the yolk sac and then dispersed cells overlying the epiblast, live imaged and 3D reconstructed. Same embryo processed for GFP mRNA. So the GFP mRNA sort of reflects the distribution of HNF4-alpha I'd shown you, which suggests that the GFP that labels these dispersed cells acts as a short-term cell lineage tracer. So we're getting perdurance. And because we're getting perdurance, we can see cells that have downregulated an extraembryonic endoderm identity. And this is actually confirmed if we look at markers such as HNF4-alpha sort of in greater detail. So we have an intervening stage. We look closely and we can see cells that are GFP positive that are staying put and are downregulating HNF4-alpha. The LOMAG sort of alluded to something else going on. So this suggests that cells are staying put, they're downregulating their extraembryonic identity, and I'm not going to show you the data, but it appears as though they upregulate an identity of definitive endoderm. So really three questions arise from these observations. So the first is, could a novel sort of widespread, multifocal sort of intercalation, we're calling it a cell aggression sort of mechanism, drive endoderm morphogenesis in the mouse and perhaps in other vertebrates? We know that visceral endoderm cells congregate around the primitive streak and midline. And finally, these data suggest, as sort of schematized here, that a lineage that Yajira talked about, the primitive endoderm, that classically is believed to be extraembryonic, may give rise to descendants within the embryo. And this is sort of in green here, are labeled visceral endoderm or primitive endoderm descendants throughout the gut tube. Okay. So the question I'm going to address today is really just the first one, but I'd be happy to talk about either of these two, which we're actively also looking at. Okay. So the question is, how does this happen? Oops. So what we sort of hypothesized was that because the visceral endoderm is an epithelium that lies next to the mesoderm, a mesenchymal layer, might cells sort of emerge or be contained within the mesoderm? So might the wings of mesoderm be a misnomer, and might they carry endoderm precursors? And might these cells insert or regress into this pre-existing epithelium? And this is actually rather interesting, because even though we know rather a lot about how cells leave epithelia, how cells ingress through the primitive streak, I think we know very little about how cells insert into pre-existing epithelia. And could endoderm morphogenesis really provide a paradigm for this type of multifocal insertion of cells into epithelia, essentially to increase their surface area? So the first thing we wanted to do, sort of before we got into this into too much detail, is to prove the hypothesis that cells originating in the primitive streak are specified as endoderm, are carried along the wings of mesoderm, and they emerge on the surface of the embryo. And to do this, we thought there's nothing sort of better than a live imaging approach to prove the point. So what we did was we took reporter-expressing mice, or embryos, we injected them with a construct that drives ubiquitous expression of a red fluorescent protein. We electroporated this construct focally into the primitive streak. We cultured until we could see red fluorescence within the primitive streak, and then we time-lapse imaged on a laser scanning confocal. So this is a 3D reconstruction, and I'm just going to sort of orient you, of just half an embryo. So sort of, as I mentioned, the mouse embryo at this stage is cup-shaped. So we've cut it the way one would a melon, and we can actually look inside, and then because this is three-dimensional data, we can rotate and actually look back on the outside. So this, you're going to have to believe me, is the primitive streak. I'm going to show you a movie that will, I think, confirm this is the streak that we've hit. And this is just to show you this is 3D data. There's the sort of squamous epithelium we've labeled with GFP on the outside, and these cells that we've labeled with a red fluorescent protein, sort of mosaically, internally. And these I've tried to convince you are labeling the primitive streak. This is the embryo, and this is just a DIC image to show you that this is a real embryo. This is back to the dark field, and this is just a time-lapse sequence where you'll see that these cells effectively undergo an EMT, and they migrate out in an arc, which is what is expected of the wings of mesoderm. Okay. So we can effectively label individual cells in situ and visualize them in mouse embryos as they gastrulate. We can sort of visualize individual behavior such as EMT, sort of oriented projections in the direction of movement. And then to kind of prove our model, do these cells, if we take this data set and we time-lapse it, but image it from the surface or on the surface, can we see cells emerge on the surface? And the answer is yes, we do. Okay. Of course, not all regions that avoid a fluorescence will be red fluorescent positive, because we're mosaically labeled cells coming out of the primitive streak. Okay. So then we took some mutants, because we use mutants a lot, and we thought, well, if they originate in the primitive streak, can we, you know, we would hypothesize that mutants that affect gastrulation and the movement of cells out of the streak would not have visceral endoderm dispersal. And these are mutants that affect the FGF signaling pathway, FGF receptor 1 and FGF8, and again, they don't. And eomesoderm, which is a T-box transcription factor that we're interested in, which is sort of involved in specification or EMT of cells at the streak and endoderm lineage commitment, that also sort of has a complete failure to disperse. These are very sort of mutants with very severe defects. So even though they sort of prove a point, they only prove it to a certain sort of, they only sort of go so far as to prove that cells emerging from the streak sort of drive the dispersal. Okay. So then I just thought I'd show you this sort of set of images of embryos that are sort of literally cover a less than 12-hour period from what we call early, mid, and late visceral endoderm dispersal. And these are whole mount side views, again, all 3D reconstructions, and then sections, which are, we've counterstained with sort of a nuclear die. This is actually a static set of images. And what I'd like to point out is that at no point is this region of dispersal sort of running anterior of the wings of mesoderm, again, supporting the hypothesis that cells are coming out of the wings of the mesoderm. And if you look carefully over here at early versus sort of mid, and this is a high mag of the dispersal, you'll see that there are indentations into this sort of endoderm, suggesting that cells are sort of emerging or popping out of the mesoderm and inserting into this outer squamous epithelium. And then by 7.5 days, there's an epithelium that you're just going to have to sort of believe me at this point, but I will show you some data later. Really, it comprises cells of two origins and really has sort of very kind of not sort of standard sort of epithelial morphology. Okay, so I mentioned that we'd looked at gastrulation defects, but I had said that these are really quite severe mutants that affect a lot of things. So what we decided to do is to reinvestigate some mutants that have been characterized in genes that are evolutionarily conserved that drive endoderm specification and morphogenesis. And the gene I'm going to talk to you about today, or the mutant, is that of the HMG box domain transcription factor SOX17. So SOX17 is a mutant that was sort of reported over a decade ago by Patrick Tam and colleagues as having an endoderm defect. SOX17 was also a factor that was sort of reported by Janet Rossenden and colleagues as being sufficient for directing human embryonic stem cells into an endoderm progenitor state. So we thought we'd look at SOX17 mutants, but before we did, we'd ask the question of where exactly is SOX17 expressed at these stages. And rather gratifyingly, SOX17 is expressed in cells before they sort of pop out onto the surface of the embryo, at a time where cells are committing or have committed to an endoderm sort of lineage. And then if we look over time, and these are just 3D reconstructions that my graduate student has made that fade in and out channels, you'll see cells coming to the surface of SOX17 positive. After dispersal is complete, cells, irrespective of their origin, express SOX17 equally, suggesting a state of equivalence is achieved between two populations of cells of distinct origin, one of the epiblast and one of the extraembryonic visceral endoderm. And this is sort of schematized over here. And what about the mutant? So the mutants are interesting, or they are to us, because at sort of a mid-gestation, they do look quite different from their sort of wild-type sort of littermates. But really, sort of after sort of, subsequent to the formation of the gut endoderm on the surface of the embryo, one would be hard-pressed to identify a mutant from a wild-type embryo based on gross morphology. People who are familiar with embryos or mouse embryos will notice that there may be issues in sort of laterality, but by gross morphology, this looks very similar, if a little bit more advanced than this embryo over here. If we look by markers, so these are by in situ, this is just a pan-visceral endoderm marker in a wild-type embryo versus a mutant. We see it's been sort of as one would expect, downregulated in the mutant, in this region overlying sort of the epiblast. However, if we use our GFP reporter, we note a very profound defect, and that is that here is an embryo with three distinct tissue layers, a mesoderm, an epiblast, and a visceral endoderm, but the entire endoderm tissue layer is visceral endoderm derived, or extraembryonic derived, suggesting that there is a complete failure of visceral endoderm dispersal. But coupled with the previous data that suggests downregulation of a visceral endoderm identity, this would suggest that an extraembryonic identity is downregulated in the absence of this widespread sort of aggression and intercalation. And this is just to confirm, using a different allele, where we've had SOX17 knocked, or GFP knocked into the SOX17 locus, where we can sort of document SOX17 reporter activity in the absence of SOX17 gene function. We can identify SOX17 positive cells in mutants within the wings of mesoderm, suggesting that they originated in the wings of mesoderm, failed to make it to the surface of the embryo. Okay. So when we started to think about this data, so one sort of persistent sort of question plagued us. And this is why I was asking Yujiro this question, because we started to think about basement membranes. And if one thinks about the configuration of this sort of a three tissue layer type structure as an agastrula, you have epiblast, mesoderm, and then this gut endoderm. And each of these tissue layers, as in the blastocyst, is separated by a basement membrane. So the question arose in our mind as to how do cells traverse the basement membrane to pop out? And I have to say that my poor graduate student, sort of, I drove her mad, and she tried very hard to look at the localization of various proteins that might degrade basement membranes, such as MMPs. And then we had this epiphany, which came a few months too late, but where we realized that gastrulation, or any tissue sort of remodeling event, sort of drives the formation the transformation of a two-layered embryo into one comprising three layers, formation of an intervening mesenchymal layer. But it also promotes the transformation of a single basement membrane into two. And this is something, in talking to colleagues, that we hadn't really considered, and I don't think many others have. How do you really, concomitant with the formation of additional tissue layers, how do you segregate them? Do you transform existing basement membranes into two, or do you deposit new sort of basement membranes? And this is just a fibronectin stain, pre-gastrulation, at gastrulation, to really demonstrate that there are two basement membranes sort of separating the different tissue layers. Okay. So we sort of effectively came up with two models that are not necessarily sort of mutually exclusive. Firstly, as the mesoderm migrates, so the question is, how do you make transform one basement membrane into two? And the first model is, as the mesoderm migrates, does it bifurcate the existing basement membrane and then reinforce it? Alternatively, might the mesoderm migrate on one existing basement membrane and deposit a second? So in this case, I've shown you the deposition of a de novo basement membrane at the interface between endoderm and mesoderm. Of course, it could happen the other way around. The mesoderm could perhaps migrate on a basement membrane positioned at the interface with the endoderm and deposit a second basement membrane over here. The reason I'm showing this is that this is what I think is going on, and what I'm going to try and sort of convince you is taking place. Okay. So what we decided to do is to look, again, in carefully staged embryos during this sequence of events. So these are hole mount views, and these are sections. And looking at sort of the organization of the basement membrane. There are several constituents that are prominent in the basement membrane of gastrula and pre-implantation mouse embryos. So we've looked at fibronectin, we've looked at laminins A1 and B1, and we've looked at collagen. This just shows the fibronectin data. What we sort of interpret this as suggesting, though it doesn't prove it, is that there may be the de novo assembly of a basement membrane at the mesoderm-endoderm interface. What we also noted, which I think is very intriguing, and speaks a little to some of the cell sorting and polarity issues that Yujiro was discussing earlier, is that during the formation of this gut endoderm, there is an intermediate stage where the endoderm comprises a multi-layered intermediate that then sorts. This is shown a little bit sort of clearer here. Here are the two basement membranes. These are these GFP-negative cells that lie adjacent to the GFP-positive cells. These GFP-negative cells are SOX17-positive at this point. So we thought, well, if this is the case, what happens to the basement membrane in SOX17 mutants? And this is a wild type, and this is a mutant. This is a HIMAG view looking at the two basement membranes and the three tissue layers. Visceral endoderm is labeled with this AFP-GFP. And you can see the entire visceral endoderm is GFP positive here. And you'll also notice, and I'm going to play the movie, a very profound defect in addition to this sort of surface layer of the embryo that is completely visceral endoderm derived. There is an absence of a basement membrane at the endoderm-mesoderm interface. Let me just play the movie. Okay. which suggests that SOC 17 is required for the specification of definitive endoderm cells. For their failure to be specified results in their failure to egress, and that perhaps definitive endoderm cells are depositing the basement membrane. Okay. This is just to convince you these are mutants versus wild types, different basement membrane components to the MUBI, laminin A1 and fibronectin. And again, in the wild type embryos we see two, in the mutants we only see a single basement membrane at the epiblast mesoderm interface. So the hypothesis we initially entertained was, well, SOC17 is a transcription factor. Might SOC17 be directly regulating the expression of basement genes encoding basement membrane components? And the answer is, to an extent, yes. And this is why this is sort of very much a work in progress, and I would appreciate any suggestions, sort of comments or insight. So to address this question, what we did was we took a favorite sort of a model for people like us using the mouse as a model, and that's embryonic stem cells, mouse embryonic stem cells in this case. And we used a standard protocol, an activin-based protocol, to direct them to differentiate into endoderm progenitors. We actually have derived embryonic stem cells from this SOC17 GFP allele that are otherwise sort of normal, but they report the expression of SOC17. And you can see they're GFP positive. And then we can sort of flow sort or not, as the case may be, depending on the purity of our directed differentiation. And then we can do CHIP. And effectively what I'd like to show is these are definitive endoderm cells in red, are the ones that we've directed to differentiate out of ES cells. And our control is these ZEN cells, which are extraembryonic endoderm cells. So essentially we've managed to CHIP on the promoter of laminin A1, B1, and collagen, but not fibronectin, SOC17, suggesting that it could be involved in the direct sort of regulation of the expression of these genes. But as we were doing this, we decided to do a parallel experiment, threw our model a little bit out of joint. And this was this experiment, the kind of experiment that many mouse embryologists do, which is a Holmont in situ experiment. This is a wild-type embryo. This is laminin A1. We've also done in situs for fibronectin and laminin B1 and collagen. And this is a SOC17 mutant. And this is this was a rather disappointing result that we've repeated far too many times to mention. But essentially what this is suggesting is that in mutants, we have we observe no qualitative difference in the amount of fibronectin sort of expressed. It also suggests, I think, for Lloydy sort of Yuzhou, who might be interested, that anterior of the wings of mesoderm, there is no expression of ECM proteins, so that the ECM that pre-exists between the epiblast and the visceral endoderm must be laid down at the blastocyst stage and perhaps reinforced at early post-implantation. But this was very disappointing. We still need to quantify to see if there's a one or two-fold difference. But what this suggests is that there is a complex sort of mechanism involved in the deposition of the basement membrane. And what we've started to consider, and I'm going to show you some preliminary data, because this is data that we got over the last couple of months. Had I given this sort of talk in December, it would end at the previous slide and there would be your mechanism. But now we have to rethink. And we've started to think about polarity. Okay. So could really the mechanism lie in a post-transcriptional sort of behavior? And this is what we're thinking at the moment, and I'd really like sort of some feedback. So if we consider sort of what's going on as cells, these definitive endoderm, GFP-negative cells are coming to the surface. And if we sort of consider whenever we see the basement membrane, it's always sort of located at their future basolateral sort of extremity. We never see basement membrane in front of them. And we've confirmed this with SOC17 expression and SOC17 reporter, suggesting that if these cells are involved in the deposition, either transcriptionally or non-transcriptionally, of this basement membrane, They, they, they must do so after they've acquired some aspect of an apical-basal polarity. Because we always see the basement membrane behind these cells, and this is sort of schematized over here. Never in front. They're never bathed in a basal lamina. Furthermore, what we're detecting here is an assembled basal lamina. So what we're currently considering is, as definitive endoderm cells sort of upregulate or express SOC17, they commit to an endoderm fate, and they go through a process of popping in or egressing into pre-existing epithelia. I'm using egression as the opposite of ingression, the extrusion of cells from epithelia. As they do so, they must undergo a sequence of mesenchymal to epithelial transition, which must involve the acquisition of an apico-basal polarity. Might this acquisition of polarity lead to the clustering, in this case the basal lateral clustering, of receptors for ECM proteins? And in our case, integrin alpha-4. We're interested in integrin alpha-4 because it's expressed at this stage, and also the mutant effects, sort of several aspects of early mouse development around the gastro stage. Might this basal lateral receptor clustering then lead to the focal assembly of a basement membrane? And that coincident with egression and polarization comes the deposition of a basement membrane that will eventually separate the endoderm over here, shown here as a multi-layered intermediate, from the mesoderm over here. And what about the data to address this model? And I have to say, this is sort of new data, and it's still very much a work in progress. We started looking at E-cadherin. We'd expect E-cadherin to be apically localized in endoderm cells, shown here with an orange asterisk, as they're coming to the surface of the embryo, over here. And integrin alpha-5 to be basolaterally localized in these cells, they come to the surface, over here. We think this is still preliminary. And then in mutants, cells have failed to be specified, and we fail to see a polarized distribution of integrin alpha-5. Okay. And this is one final piece of data, and I don't know if it will show up over here, which is, again, using the SOC17 GFP allele, where we can identify cells that have failed to commit to an endoderm identity, that are trapped in the wings of mesoderm because they haven't been able to pop into the surface endoderm layer. This is an E-cadherin stain, and you can see sort of remnants of E-cadherin suggesting that they tried but failed to execute a program of apico-basal polarity. And this is really my last slide, where I'm just sort of schematizing sort of what I've sort of told you today, the mutant that affects this process, and the sequence of events that I think are beginning to define the aggression of definitive endoderm cells into this extraembryonic visceral endoderm. That drive the formation of the gut endoderm that comprises cells of two distinct origins. And what we think is going on is that SOC17 must lie sort of high up in this sort of cascade, and that the process involves the acquisition of polarity, the concomitant dispersal of this visceral endoderm, and somehow has to be linked with the basal lateral or assembly of a basement membrane that separates the different tissue layers. And then we think this is also sort of linked to the resolution of a monolayered epithelium. I should perhaps stress that we've analyzed additional mutants that have allowed us to separate sort of these events into this sequence that I haven't really talked about today. Okay, so I think this is my last slide. And before I sort of end, I should just tell you about who's done the work. And the project sort of looking at the endoderm, which is something that I never thought I would look at, was initiated by my first graduate student, Gloria Kwon. Most of the data that I showed you today was sort of the work or the efforts of another graduate student, Manuel Viotti, and two other members of the lab, Maria Polina and Sonia Novochin. And these individuals over here gave us mice. And I think I will stop there. Thank you for listening, and take any questions. And actually, before I forget, I just wanted, for anyone working on mouse models and mouse genetic models, I wanted to just draw your attention to this meeting that's been running for several decades now and alternates between Europe and the United States. And this year it's in Europe. And anyone who's interested in attending, we're still accepting abstracts.
Okay. It's very interesting. And then I'm wondering that those visceral endoderm-derived endoderm.
Yes.
Are they staying in the adult mice, and okay. Is there any functional difference?
Or okay. So these were the slides that I took out of my presentation because I thought I would run long. But this is a very important question. And the question that Yorijiro is asking is, what is the fate of the visceral endoderm? You know, could I essentially be just telling you about a morphogenetic process that results in getting definitive endoderm cells to the surface? Might these visceral endoderm cells never really proliferate and contribute to the fetus? May they just be there as a scaffold? So to address this question, so the first live imaging, but I don't have the live imaging data here, after the dispersal of the visceral endoderm shows that they proliferate. The real question is, can we actually pulse chase them, or can we identify them into the adult? So we're setting up to do this, but it's not a straightforward experiment. The way we're trying to do this is using an inducible Cre. So we're taking these pan-visceral endoderm Cre drivers that we've made, we're making them inducible Cre, so tamoxifen inducible Cre versions, and we're pulsing before gastrulation and chasing after. This is a tricky experiment because you pulse with tamoxifen and you don't get many embryos out. So we're sort of tweaking the tamoxifen, but this is some of the data that we have that is encouraging, but we need more. And I think I'll. So this is data at gastrular stages. This is our sort of our regular Cre driven by TTR. So we've made a TTR Cre RT2. We're pulsing at different stages. We can chase cohorts. We can't label the entire visceral endoderm and recover embryos, but we can chase cohorts of cells. We've made a similar Cre, because it always is good to make your Cre two different ways, so that what you can confirm your observations with a different mouse model, give similar labeling. If we go to later gestational stages, the yolk sac is a positive control. This is the liver and the intestine. We do see descendants. So at least in this case, until 12 and a half days, we do see descendants, which would suggest that these cells do contribute to later fetal stages. I would hypothesize that they continue to contribute, and we will find them in adult stages when we manage to get the tamoxifen dosing right to do this experiment to chase visceral endoderm descendants into these sort of later sort of postnatal stages.
So second question I have is, have you ever seen this process in EM? And then can you, for example, a faint cell coming out, can you identify?
Okay. I think there's several. So no one has seen this in EM. But I think in EM, you have to really treat your embryos rather harshly to process them. You put them through ethanol and then coat them. So that's, I think you probably do if you know what to look for. I don't have slides of this, but we have started to look at the morphology of the visceral endoderm epithelium as cells come through and insert. And we find something that's very preliminary, so I haven't included a slide, but it's actually very, I think, tantalizing. So if we look at the arrangement of cells within the visceral endoderm epithelium during aggression, we actually see cells egress at a very characteristic structure. So people who might be familiar with sort of some of the sort of past decade of work on the organization of epithelia, ordered epithelia in hexagonal arrays, and those are disordered, not really being perfect hexagons, may be familiar with sort of several instances where people have described structures of multicellular rosettes, which are thermodynamically unfavorable structures. So essentially what it looks as though, but again, we need to make more strains, and this is, again, preliminary. It appears as though definitive endoderm cells will ingress at the vertex of a multicellular rosette within the visceral endoderm epithelium. We know that the rosette is thermodynamically unfavorable. So could it be, and it may also contain a paucity of junctions. So it perhaps represents a portal where cells can come to the surface. It will then collapse when perturbed. It will and provide the space for cells to come through. Every time we have seen cells come to the surface, they come at the vertex of a rosette. And we only ever see, well, Shankar Srinivas has published that at earlier stages he sees rosettes in the visceral endoderm overlying the epiblast. Those continue to be observed in the visceral endoderm overlying the epiblast at gastrular stages, and it is the vertex of those rosettes that really, at least initially, is the region where cells will enter that epithelium. And this is really, I think, the reverse of a process that Jody Rosenblatt's lab and I think Baz Baum in the UK have described in Drosophila, zebrafish, and in tissue culture cells, where they're looking at cell extrusion for epithelia, because when cells extrude, they leave in their wake a cellular organization which takes the form of a rosette. So I'm wondering whether this egression that we're characterizing is the reverse process of cell extrusion, but that really needs a lot of working on.
Thank you for your lovely talk. I know that most of your data was using your SOX mutants, but my curiosity was piqued when I saw that you refer to the FGFR1 signaling as part of this process, because fate specification and GnRH neuronal migration have been studied by, I think, PaySci. And, you know, some patients who have GnRH deficiency and FGFR1 pathway mutations have abnormalities. We call them midline facial defects. A lot of them have cleft lip and palate, and many of them have digital anomalies, webbed fingers, crooked fingers, syndactyly, a variety of anomalies. And I was just, you know, wondering whether or not some of the mechanisms that you're working out at these very early stages of development on polarity and development of the basement membrane might inform developmental biologists who are studying later stages.
Definitely, and you should be reading my NIH grant, because that's how we try and sell ourselves.